Hey folks, Rich Outfield from the future here. This is the moment where typically I give you a little warning. There's a content-ish bit in this. It's a story, it's a book from almost 100 years ago. And so there are a couple of elements that some would call problematic today. And normally I would say, if you have a problem with that or think you may have a problem with that, or you just plain don't like Robert E. Howard's writing, then give this one a skip. But I'm not going to say that, because I am recording this in late 2022. So it's almost a whole year after I started this episode. It was an incredible amount of work. If you look at the runtime, you'll see part of what I'm talking about. But I just finished editing the story today. And it was exhausting, especially toward the end, when it became harder and harder to keep these names straight. I called Conan a few times, and I was like, oh, shoot, do I need to go back and redo that? There were so many nonsense names and places, and then words for medieval weaponry that I didn't know how to pronounce. It was just exhausting. So as I said, normally I would tell you, just skip this episode if you think you'll have a problem with it. But I can't say that, because so much work went into it. Just grit your teeth, listen for the next hour and a half or so, next 3 hours, and think about England. Think about jolly old England, mate. See ya. Good late afternoon. This is Rich Outfield, and you are listening to the podcast that dares not speak its name. I am presenting to you today another Robert E. Howard story in the Conan series. This one called The Scarlet Citadel. And if you listened to a recent episode where I presented The Phoenix on the Sword, I explained that I sat down and I recorded a story, this one, and then remembered that I had a Conan recording from 2010 that I had never presented. And so I shared that episode, The Phoenix on the Sword, and now we're presenting the one that I recorded in 2021, which,
say what?
Stop it!
Which is a long story. It was a process in getting it recorded. I think the battery died about halfway through the recording, and I didn't realize it until I looked down and the light was no longer lit. And then I put in a new battery and I continued recording, and I got to about 70%, 75% recorded, and then the space ran out on the recorder. So it ended up taking 3 sittings to get this done. But I hope that you feel it was worth it. I hope that you like the production and that you like the story. This story is from 1933, or rather it was first published in 1933 in Weird Tales magazine, January 1933. This one takes place a long time after the other two stories, Conan stories that I have done on this show. Although the first one was so long ago, like 2009 or so, that I don't know
about that,
even how I presented it, or if it's even available anymore. I was given by my friend Jeff a book of the Howard Conan stories in chronological order. And, when I say chronological, in the order in which they were published. And this is the third story in that book, after, I believe, Frost Giant's Daughter and Phoenix on the Sword. And so, I suppose it's conceivable I could go through every single story in the book if I wanted to, if people like it. This is the story where, before I sat down to record it, I asked on Facebook if Conan should have an Austrian accent or not. And there were a couple of people who said no, but most people said yes. And
I guess for consistency's sake, it's the same voice that I did the other two with. But this one has a bunch of interesting characters that were a challenge to do voices for, and so we'll see what you think of it if you listen all the way through, because it's a long one.
Don't go there.
Obviously, Robert E. Howard was an American author who was famous for his pulp fiction in a diverse range of genres, and he is regarded as the father of the sword and sorcery subgenre. But he wrote westerns, boxing stories, historical fiction, horror, and something called Southern Gothic. He died in 1936 at the age of 30.
The Scarlet Citadel by Robert E. Howard. Narrated by Rish Outfield. 1. They trapped the lion on Shamu's plain. They weighted his limbs with an iron chain. They cried aloud in the trumpet blast. They cried, "The lion is caged at last." Woe to the cities of river and plain, if ever the lion stalks again. Old Ballad. The roar of battle had died away. The shout of victory mingled with the cries of the dying. Like gay-hued leaves after an autumn storm, the fallen littered the plain. The sinking sun shimmered on burnished helmets, gilt-worked mail, silver breastplates, broken swords, and the heavy regal folds of silken standards overthrown in pools of curdling crimson. In silent heaps lay war horses and their steel-clad riders, flowing manes and blowing plumes stained alike in the red tide. About them and among them, like the drift of a storm, were strewn slashed and trampled bodies in steel caps and leather jerkins, archers and pikemen. The olifants sounded a fanfare of triumph over all the plain, and the hoofs of the victors crunched in the breasts of the vanquished, as all the straggling, shining lines converged inward, like the spokes of a glittering wheel, to the spot where the last survivor still waged unequal strife. That day, Conan, king of Aquilonia, had seen the pick of his chivalry cut to pieces, smashed and hammered to bits, and swept into eternity. With 5,000 knights, he had crossed the southeastern border of Aquilonia and ridden into the grassy meadowlands of Ophir to find his former ally, King Amalrus of Ophir, drawn up against him with the hosts of Strabonus, king of Koth. Too late he had seen the trap. All that a man might do, he had done, with his 5,000 cavalrymen against the 30,000 knights, archers, and spearmen of the conspirators. Without bowmen or infantry, he had hurled his armored horsemen against the oncoming host, had seen the knights of his foes in their shining mail go down before his lances, had torn the opposing center to bits, driving the riven ranks headlong before him, only to find himself caught in a vice as the untouched wings closed in. Strabonus's Shemitish bowmen had wrought havoc among his knights, feathering them with shafts that found every crevice in their armor, shooting down the horses, the Kothian pikmen rushing in to spear the fallen riders. The mailed lancers of the routed center had reformed, reinforced by the riders from their wings, and had charged again and again, sweeping the field by sheer weight of numbers. The Aquilonians had not fled. They had died on the field. And of the 5,000 knights who had followed Conan southward, not one left the field alive. And now the king himself stood at bay among the slashed bodies of his house troops, his back against a heap of dead horses and men. Ophirian knights in gilded mail leaped their horses over mounds of corpses to slash at the solitary figure. Squat Shemites with blue-black beards and dark-faced Kothian knights ringed him on foot. The clangor of steel rose deafeningly. The black-mailed figure of the Western king loomed among his swarming foes, dealing blows like a butcher wielding a great cleaver.
Riderless horses raced down the field. About his iron feet clad grew a ring of mangled corpses. His attackers drew back from his desperate savagery, panting and livid. Now, through the yelling, cursing lines rode the lords of the conquerors. Strabonus, with his broad, dark face and crafty eyes. Amalrus, slender, fastidious, treacherous, dangerous as a cobra. And the lean vulture, Tsatha Lanti, clad only in silken robes, his great black eyes glittering from a face that was like that of a bird of prey. Of this Kothian wizard, dark tales were told. Tousle-headed women in northern and western villages frightened children with his name, and rebellious slaves were brought to abased submission quicker than by the lash, with threat of being sold to him. Men said that he had a whole library of dark works, bound in skin flayed from living human victims, and that in nameless pits below the hill whereon his palace sat, he trafficked with the powers of darkness, trading screaming girl slaves for unholy secrets. He was the real ruler of Koth. Now he grinned bleakly as the kings reined back a safe distance from the grim, iron-clad figure looming among the dead. Before the savage blue eyes blazing murderously from beneath the crested, dented helmet, the boldest shrank. Conan's dark, scarred face was darker yet with passion. His black armor was hacked to tatters and splashed with blood, his great sword red to the crosspiece. In this stress, all the veneer of civilization had faded. It was a barbarian who faced his conquerors. Conan was a Cimmerian by birth, one of those fierce, moody hillmen who dwelt in their gloomy, cloudy land in the north. His saga, which had led him to the throne of Aquilonia, was the basis of a whole cycle of hero tales. So now the kings kept their distance, and Strabonus called on his Shemitish archers to loose their arrows at his foe from a distance. His captains had fallen like ripe grain before the Cimmerian's broadsword, and Strabonus, penurious of his knights as of his coins, was frothing with fury. But Tsotha shook his head.
"Take him alive." "Easy to say," snarled Strabonus, uneasy lest in some way the black-mailed giant might hew a path to them through the spears. "Who can take a man-eating tiger alive? By Ishtar, his heel is on the necks of my finest swordsmen. It took 7 years and stacks of gold to train each, and there they lie, so much kite's meat. Arrows, I say."
"Again, nay,"
snapped Tsotha, swinging down from his horse. He laughed coldly.
"Have you not learned by this time that my brain is mightier than any sword?"
He passed through the lines of the pikemen, and the giants in their steel caps and mail brigandines shrank fearfully, lest they so much as touch the skirts of his robe. Nor were the plumed knights slower in making room for him. He stepped over the corpses and came face to face with the grim king. The hosts watched in tense silence, holding their breath. The black-armored figure loomed in terrible menace over the lean, silk-robed shape, the notched, dripping sword hovering on high.
"I offer you life, Conan," said Tsotha, a cruel mirth bubbling at the back of his voice.
"I give you death, wizard," snarled the king, and backed by iron muscles and ferocious hate, the great sword swung in a stroke meant to shear Tsotha's lean torso in half. But even as the hosts cried out, the wizard stepped in, too quick for the eye to follow, and apparently merely laid an open hand on Conan's left forearm, from the rigid muscles of which the mail had been hacked away. The whistling blade veered from its arc, and the mailed giant crashed heavily to earth, to lie motionless. Tsotha laughed silently.
"Take him up, and fear not, the lion's fangs are drawn."
The kings reined in and gazed in awe at the fallen lion. Conan lay stiffly, like a dead man, but his eyes glared up at them, wide open and blazing with helpless fury.
What have you done to him?
Asked Amalrus uneasily. Tsotha displayed a broad ring of curious design on his finger. He pressed his fingers together, and on the inner side of the ring a tiny steel fang darted out like a snake's tongue.
It is steeped in the juice of the purple lotus, which grows in the ghost-haunted swamps of southern Stygia,
said the magician.
Its touch produces temporary paralysis. Put him in chains and lay him in a chariot. The sun sets, and it is time we were on the road for Khor Shemesh.
Strabonus turned to his general Arbanus.
We return to Khor Shemesh with the wounded. Only a troop of the royal cavalry will accompany us. Your orders are to march at dawn to the Aquilonian border and invest the city of Shamar. The Ophirians will supply you with food among the march. We will rejoin you as soon as possible with reinforcements.
So the host, with its steel-sheathed knights, its pikemen and archers and camp servants, went into camp in the meadowlands near the battlefield. And through the starry night, the two kings and the sorcerer, who was greater than any king, rode to the capital of Strabonus, in the midst of the glittering palace troop, and accompanied by a long line of chariots loaded with the wounded. In one of these chariots lay Conan, king of Aquilonia, weighted with chains, the tangle of defeat in his mouth, and blind fury of a trapped tiger in his soul. The poison which had frozen his mighty limbs to helplessness had not paralyzed his brain. As the chariot in which he lay rumbled over the meadowlands, his mind revolved maddeningly about his defeat. Amalrus had sent an emissary imploring aid against Strabonus, who, he said, was ravaging his western domain, which lay like a tapering wedge between the border of Aquilonia and the vast southern kingdom of Koth. He asked only 1,000 horsemen and the presence of Conan to hearten his demoralized subjects. Conan now mentally blasphemed. In his generosity, he had come with 5 times the number the treacherous monarch had asked. In good faith, he had ridden into Ophir and had been confronted by the supposed rivals allied against him. It spoke significantly of his prowess that they had brought a whole host to trap him and his 5,000. A red cloud veiled his vision. His veins swelled with fury, and in his temples a pulse throbbed maddeningly. All his life he had never known greater and more helpless wrath. In swift-moving scenes, the pageant of his life passed fleetingly before his mental eye, a panorama wherein moved shadowy figures which were himself in many guises and conditions, a skin-clad barbarian, a mercenary swordsman in horned helmet and scale-mail corselet, a corsair in a dragon-proud galley that trailed a crimson wake of blood and pillage along southern coasts, a captain of hosts in burnished steel, on a rearing black charger, a king on a golden throne with a lion banner flowing above, the throngs of gay-hued courtiers and ladies on their knees. But always the jouncing and rumbling of the chariot brought his thoughts back to resolve with maddening monotony about the treachery of Amalrus and the sorcery of Tsotha. The veins nearly burst in his temples, and cries of the wounded in the chariots filled him with ferocious satisfaction. Before midnight, they crossed the Ophirian border, and at dawn the spires of Khor Shemesh stood up gleaming and rose-tinted on the southeastern horizon, the slim towers overawed by the grim scarlet citadel that at a distance was like a splash of bright blood in the sky. That was the castle of Tsotha. Only one narrow street, paved with marble and guarded by heavy iron gates, led up to it, where it crowned the hill dominating the city. The sides of that hill were too sheer to be climbed elsewhere. From the walls of the citadel, one could look down on the broad white streets of the city, on minareted mosques, shops, temples, mansions, and markets. One could look down, too, on the palaces of the king, set in broad gardens, high-walled, luxurious riots of fruit trees and blossoms, through which artificial streams murmured and silvery fountains rippled incessantly. Over all brooded the citadel like a condor stooping above its prey, intent on its own dark mediations. The mighty gates between the huge towers of the outer wall clanged open, and the king rode into his capital between lines of glittering spearmen, while 50 trumpets pealed salute. But no throngs swarmed the white-paved streets to fling roses before the conqueror's hooves. Strabonus had raced ahead of news of the battle, and the people, just rousing to the occupations of the day, gaped to see their king returning with a small retinue, and were in doubt as to whether it portended victory or defeat. Conan, life sluggishly moving in his veins again, craned his neck from the chariot floor to view the wonders of this city, which men called the Queen of the South. He had thought to ride some day through these golden-chased gates at the head of his steel-clad squadrons, with the great lion banner flowing over his helmeted head. Instead, he entered in chains, stripped of his armor, and thrown like a captive slave on the bronze floor of his conqueror's chariot. A wayward, devilish mirth of mockery rose above his fury. But to the nervous soldiers who drove the chariot, his laughter sounded like the muttering of a rousing lion.
Two. Gleaming shell of an outworn lie, fable of right divine. You gained your crowns by heritage, but blood was the price of mine. The throne that I won by blood and sweat, by crom I will not sell. For promise of valleys filled with gold, or threat of the halls of hell. The Road of Kings. In the citadel, in a chamber with a domed ceiling of carven jet, and the fretted arches of doorways glimmering with strange dark jewels, a strange conclave came to pass. Conan of Aquilonia, blood from unbandaged wounds caking his huge limbs, faced his captors. On either side of him stood a dozen black giants, grasping their long shafted axes. In front of him stood Sotha, and on divans lounged Strabonus and Amalrus, in their silks and gold, gleaming with jewels, naked slave boys beside them pouring wine into cups carved of a single sapphire. In strong contrast stood Conan, grim, blood-stained, naked but for a loincloth, shackles on his mighty limbs, his blue eyes blazing beneath the tangled black mane which fell over his low, broad forehead. He dominated the scene, turning to tinsel the pomp of the conquerors by the sheer vitality of his elemental personality. And the kings in their pride and splendor were aware of it, each in their secret heart, and were not at ease. Only Tsotha was not disturbed.
"Our desires are quickly spoken, King of Aquilonia," said Tsotha. "It is our wish to extend our empire."
"And so you want to swine my kingdom?" rasped Conan.
"What are you but an adventurer, seizing a crown to which you had no more claim than any other wandering barbarian?" parried Amalrus. "We are prepared to offer you suitable compensation."
"Compensation?"
It was a gust of deep laughter from Conan's mighty chest.
"The price of infamy and treachery. I am a barbarian, so I shall sell my kingdom and its people for life and your filthy gold. Ha! How did you come to your crown, you and that black-faced pig beside you? Your fathers did the fighting and the suffering and handed their crowns to you on golden platters. What you inherited without lifting a finger, except to poison a few brothers, I fought for. You sit on satin and guzzle wine the people sweat for, and talk of divine rights of sovereignty. Bah! I climbed out of the abyss of naked barbarism to the throne, and in that climb I spilt my blood as freely as I spilt that of others. If either of us has the right to rule men, by crom it is I. How have you proved yourselves my superiors? I found Aquilonia in the grip of a pig like you, one who traced his genealogy for 1,000 years. The land was torn with the wars of the barons, and the people cried out under oppression and taxation. Today, no Aquilonian noble dares maltreat the humblest of my subjects, and the taxes of the people are lighter than anywhere else in the world. What of you? Your brother, Amaurus, holds the eastern half of your kingdom and defies you. And you, Strabonus, your soldiers are even now besieging castles of a dozen or more rebellious barons. The people of both your kingdoms are crushed into the earth by tyrannous taxes and levies. And you would loot mine. Ha! Free my hands and I'll varnish this floor with your brains.
Sotha grinned bleakly to see the rage of his kingly companions.
All this, truthful though it be, is beside the point. Our plans are no concern of yours. Your responsibility is at an end when you sign this parchment, which is an abdication in favor of Prince Arpello of Pelia. We will give you your arms and horse, and 5,000 gold lunas, and escort you to the eastern frontier.
Setting me adrift where I was when I rode into Aquilonia to take service in her armies, except with the added burden of a traitor's name.
Conan's laugh was like the deep, short bark of a timber wolf.
Ha! Ha! Arpello, eh? I've had suspicions of that butcher of Pelia. Can you not even steal and pillage, frankly and honestly? But you must have an excuse, however thin. Arpello claims a trace of royal blood, so you use him as an excuse for theft and a satrap to rule through. I'll see you in hell first.
You're a fool, exclaimed Almaris. You are in our hands, and we can take both crown and life at our pleasure.
Conan's answer was neither kingly nor dignified, but characteristically instinctive in the man, whose barbaric nature had never been submerged in his adopted culture. He spat full in Amalrus's eyes. The king of Ophir leaped up with a scream of outraged fury, groping for his slender sword. Drawing it, he rushed at the Cimmerian, but Sotha interfered.
Wait, your majesty. This man is my prisoner.
Aside, wizard!
Shrieked Amalrus, maddened by the glare of the Cimmerian's blue eyes.
Back, I say!
Roared Sotha, roused to awesome wrath. His lean hand came from his wide sleeve and cast a shower of dust into the Ophirian's contorted face. Amalrus cried out and staggered back, clutching at his eyes, the sword falling from his hand. He dropped limply on the divan, while the Kothian guards looked on stolidly, and King Strabonus hurriedly gulped another goblet of wine, holding it with hands that trembled. Amalrus lowered his hands and shook his head violently, intelligence slowly sifting back into his gray eyes.
"I went blind!"
he growled.
"What did you do to me, wizard?"
"Merely a gesture to convince you who was the real master,"
snapped Sotha, the mask of his formal pretense dropped, revealing the naked evil personality of the man.
"Strabonus has learned his lesson. Let you learn yours." It was but a dust I found in a Stygian tomb which I flung into your eyes. If I brush out their sight again, I will leave you to grope in darkness for the rest of your life.
Amalrus shrugged his shoulders, smiled whimsically, and reached for a goblet, dissembling his fear and fury. A polished diplomat, he was quick to regain his poise. Sotha turned to Conan, who had stood imperturbably during the episode. At the wizard's gesture, the blacks laid hold of their prisoner and marched him behind Sotha, who led the way out of the chamber through an arched doorway into a winding corridor, whose floor was of many-hued mosaics, whose walls were inlaid with gold tissue and silver chasing, and from whose fretted arched ceiling swung golden censers, filling the corridor with dreamy perfumed clouds. They turned down a smaller corridor, done in jet and black jade, gloomy and awful, which ended at a brass door, over whose arch a human skull grinned horrifically. At this door stood a fat, repellent figure, dangling a bunch of keys. Sotha's chief eunuch, Shukeli, of whom grisly tales were whispered, a man with whom a bestial lust for torture took the place of normal human passions. The brass door led onto a narrow stair that seemed to wind down into the very bowels of the hill on which the citadel stood. Down these stairs went the band, to halt at last at an iron door, the strength of which seemed unnecessary. Evidently it did not open on outer air, yet it was built as if to withstand a battering of mangonels and rams. Shukeli opened it, and as he swung back the ponderous portal, Conan noted the evident uneasiness among the black giants who guarded him. Nor did Shukeli seem altogether devoid of nervousness as he peered into the darkness beyond. Inside the great door there was a second barrier, composed of heavy steel bars. It was fastened by an ingenious bolt which had no lock, and could be worked only from the outside. This bolt shot back, the grill slid into the wall. They passed through into a broad corridor, the floor, walls, and arched ceiling of which seemed to be cut out of solid stone. Conan knew he was far underground, even below the hill itself. The darkness pressed in on the guardsmen's torches like a sentient, animate thing. They made the king fast to a ring in the stone wall. Above his head, in a niche in the wall, they placed a torch, so that he stood in a dim semicircle of light. The blacks were anxious to be gone. They muttered among themselves and cast fearful glances at the darkness. Sotha motioned them out, and they filed through the door in stumbling haste, as if fearing that the darkness might take tangible form and spring upon their backs. Sotha turned toward Conan, and the king noticed uneasily that the wizard's eyes shone in the semi-darkness, and that his teeth much resembled the fangs of a wolf, gleaming whitely in the shadows.
"And so farewell, barbarian," mocked the sorcerer. "I must ride to Shamar and the siege. In 10 days I will be in your palace in Tamar with my warriors. What word from you shall I say to your women before I flay their dainty skins for scrolls whereon to chronicle the triumphs of Sothalanti?"
Conan answered with a searing Sumerian curse that would have burst the eardrums of an ordinary man, and Sotha laughed thinly and withdrew. Conan had a glimpse of his vulture-like figure through the thick-set bars as he slid home the grate, and the heavy outer door clanged, and silence fell like a pall. 3. The lion strode through the halls of hell. Across his path grim shadows fell, of many a mowing nameless shape, monsters with dripping jaws agape. The darkness shuddered with scream and yell when the lion stalked through the halls of hell. Old Ballad. King Conan tested the ring in the wall and the chain that bound him. His limbs were free, but he knew that his shackles were beyond even his iron strength. The links of the chain were as thick as his thumb and were fastened to a band of steel about his waist, a band broad as his hand and half an inch thick. The sheer weight of his shackles would have slain a lesser man with exhaustion. The locks that held band and chain were massive affairs that a sledgehammer could hardly have dinted. As for the ring, evidently it went clear through the wall and was clinched on the other side. Conan cursed, and panic surged through him as he glared into the darkness that pressed against the half-circle of light. All the superstitious dread of the barbarian slept in his soul, untouched by civilized logic. His primitive imagination peopled the subterranean darkness with grisly shapes. Besides, his reason told him that he had not been placed there merely for confinement. His captors had no reason to spare him. He had been placed in these pits for a definite doom. He cursed himself for his refusal of their offer, even while his stubborn manhood revolted at the thought, and he knew that were he taken forth and given another chance, his reply would be the same. He would not sell his subjects to the butcher. And yet it had been with no thought of anyone's gain but his own that he had seized the kingdom originally. Thus subtly does the instinct of sovereign responsibility enter even a red-handed plunderer sometimes. Conan thought of Sotha's last abominable threat, and groaned in sick fury, knowing it was no idle boast. Men and women were to the wizard no more than the writhing insect is to the scientist. Soft white hands that had caressed him, red lips that had been pressed to his, dainty white bosoms that had quivered to his hot, fierce kisses, to be stripped of their delicate skin, white as ivory and pink as young petals. From Conan's lips burst a yell so frightful and inhuman in its mad fury that a listener would have stared in horror to know that it came from a human throat. The shuddering echoes made him start and brought back his own situation vividly to the king. He glared fearsomely at the outer gloom and thought of the grisly tales he had heard of Sotha's necromantic cruelty, and it was with an icy sensation down his spine that he realized that these must be the very halls of horror named in shuddering legendry, the tunnels and dungeons wherein Sotha performed horrible experiments with beings human, bestial, and, it was whispered, demoniac, tampering blasphemously with the naked basic elements of life itself. Rumor said that the mad poet Rinaldo had visited these pits and had been shown horrors by the wizard, and that the nameless monstrosities of which he had hinted in his awful poem, The Song of the Pit, were no mere fantasies of a disordered brain. That brain had crashed to dust beneath Conan's battle-axe on the night the king had fought for his life with the assassins the mad rhymer had led into the betrayed palace. But the shuddersome words of that grisly song still rang in the king's ears as he stood there in his chains. Even with that thought, the Cimmerian was frozen by a soft rustling sound, blood freezing in its implication. He tensed in an attitude of listening, painful in its intensity. An icy hand stroked his spine. It was the unmistakable sound of pliant scales slithering softly over stone. Cold sweat beaded his skin, as beyond the ring of dim light he saw a vague and colossal form, awful even in its indistinctiveness. It reared upright, swaying slightly, and yellow eyes burned icily on him from the shadows. Slowly, a huge, hideous, wedge-shaped head took form before his dilated eyes, and from the darkness oozed, in flowing, scaly coils, the ultimate horror of reptilian development. It was a snake that dwarfed all Conan's previous ideas of snakes. 80 feet it stretched from its pointed tail to its triangular head, which was bigger than that of a horse. In the dim light its scales glistened coldly, white as hoarfrost. Surely this reptile was one born and grown in darkness, yet its eyes were full of evil and sure sight. It looped its tightened coils in front of the captive, and the great head on the arching neck swayed a matter of inches from his face. Its forked tongue almost brushed his lips as it darted in and out, and its fetid odor made his senses reel with nausea. The great yellow eyes burned into his, and Conan gave back the glare of a trapped wolf. He fought against the mad impulse to grab the great arching neck in his tearing hands. Strong beyond the comprehension of civilized man, he had broken the neck of a python in a fiendish battle on the Stygian coast in his corsair days. But this reptile was venomous. He saw the great fangs, a foot long, curved like scimitars. From them dripped a colorless liquid that he instinctively knew was death. He might conceivably crush that wedge-shaped skull with a desperate clenched fist, but he knew that at his first hint of movement, the monster would strike like lightning. It was not because of any logical reasoning process that Conan remained motionless, since reason might have told him, since he was doomed anyway, to goad the snake into striking and get it over with. It was the blind, black instinct of self-preservation that held him rigid as a statue blasted out of iron. Now the great barrel reached up and the head was poised high above his own as the monster investigated the torch. A drop of venom fell on his naked thigh, and the feel of it was like a white-hot dagger driven into his flesh. Red jets of agony shot through Conan's brain. Yet he held himself immovable. Not by the twitching of a muscle or a flicker of an eyelash did he betray the pain of the hurt that left a scar he bore to the day of his death. The serpent swayed above him, as if seeking to ascertain whether there were in truth life in this figure which stood so death-like still. Then suddenly, unexpectedly, the outer door, all but invisible in the shadows, clanged stridently. The serpent, suspicious as all its kind, whipped about with a quickness incredible for its bulk, and vanished with a long-drawn slithering down the corridor. The door swung open, and remained open. The grill was withdrawn, and a huge dark figure was framed in the glow of torches outside. The figure glided in, pulled the grill partly to behind it, leaving the bolt poised. As it moved into the light of the torch over Conan's head, the king saw that it was a gigantic black man, stark naked, bearing in one hand a huge sword, and in the other a bunch of keys. The black spoke in a seacoast dialect, and Conan replied. He had learned the jargon while a corsair on the coasts of Kush.
"Long have I wished to meet you, Amra."
The black gave Conan the name, Amra, the lion, by which the Cimmerian had been known to the Kushites in his piratical days. The slave's woolly skull split in an animal-like grin, showing white tusks, but his eyes glinted redly in the torchlight.
"I have dared much for this meeting. Look, the keys to your chains. I stole them from Shekeli. What will you give me for them?"
He dangled the keys in front of Conan's eyes.
10,000 golden lunas, answered the king quickly, new hope surging fiercely in his breast.
Not enough,
cried the black, a ferocious exultation shining on his ebon countenance.
Not enough for the risks I take. Sotha's pets might come out of the dark and eat me, and if Shukeli finds out I stole his keys, he'll hang me up by my... Well, what will you give me?
15,000 lunas and the palace in Poitain, offered the king.
The black yelled and stamped in a frenzy of barbaric gratification.
More, he cried. Offer me more. What will you give me?
You black dog!
A red mist of fury swept across Conan's eyes. Were I free, I'd give you a broken back. Did Shukeli send you here to mock me?
Shukeli knows nothing of my coming, white man, answered the black, craning his thick neck to peer into Conan's savage eyes. I know you from of old, since the days when I was a chief among a free people, before the Stygians took me and sold me into the north. Do you not remember the sack of Abombi, when your sea-wolves swarmed in? Before the palace of King Ajaga, you slew a chief, and a chief fled from you. It was my brother who died. It was I who fled. I demand of you a blood price, Amra.
Free me, and I'll pay you your weight in gold pieces, growled Conan.
The red eyes glittered, the white teeth flashed wolfishly in the torchlight.
Aye, you white dog, you are like all your race, but to a black man gold can never pay for blood. The price I ask is your head!
The last word was a maniacal shriek that sent the echoes shivering. Conan tensed, unconsciously straining against his shackles in his abhorrence of dying like a sheep. Then he was frozen by a greater horror. Over the black shoulder he saw a vague, horrific form swaying in the darkness.
Sotha will never know!
Laughed the black fiendishly, too engrossed in his gloating triumph to take heed of anything else, too drunk with hate to know that death swayed behind his shoulder.
He will not come into the vaults until the demons have torn your bones from their chains! I will have your head, Amra!
He braced his knotted legs like ebon columns and swung up the massive sword in both hands, his great black muscles rolling and cracking in the torchlight. And at that instant, the titanic shadow behind him darted down and out, and the wedge-shaped head smote with an impact that re-echoed down the tunnels. Not a sound came from the thick, blubbery lips that flew wide in fleeting agony. With the thud of the stroke, Conan saw the life go out of the wide black eyes with the suddenness of a candle blown out. The blow knocked the great black body clear across the corridor, and horribly, the gigantic sinuous shape whipped around it in glistening coils that hid it from view, and the snap and splintering of bones came plainly to Conan's ears. Then something made his heart leap madly. The sword and the keys had flown from the black's hands to crash and jangle on the stone, and the keys lay almost at the king's feet. He tried to bend to them, but the chain was too short. Almost suffocated by the mad pounding of his heart, he slipped one foot from its sandal and gripped to them with his toes. Drawing his foot up, he grasped them fiercely, barely stifling the yell of ferocious exultation that rose instinctively to his lips. An instant's fumbling with the huge locks, and he was free. He caught up the fallen sword and glared about. Only empty darkness met his eyes, into which the serpent had dragged a mangled, tattered object that only faintly resembled a human body. Conan turned to the open door. A few quick strides brought him to the threshold. A squeal of high-pitched laughter shrilled through the vaults, and the grill shot home under his very fingers. The bolt crashed down. Through the bars peered a face like a fiendishly mocking carven gargoyle, Shukili the eunuch, who had followed his stolen keys. Surely he did not, in his gloating, see the sword in the prisoner's hand. With a terrible curse, Conan struck as a cobra strikes. The great blade hissed between the bars, and Shukili's laughter broke in a death scream. The fat eunuch bent at the middle, as if bowing to his killer, and crumpled like tallow, his pudgy hands clutching vainly at his spilling entrails. Conan snarled in savage satisfaction, but he was still a prisoner. His keys were futile against the bolt, which could be worked only from the outside. His experienced touch told him the bars were hard as the sword. An attempt to hew his way to freedom would only splinter his one weapon. Yet he found dents on those adamantine bars, like the marks of incredible fangs, and wondered with an involuntary shudder what nameless monsters had so terribly assailed the barriers. Regardless, there was but one thing for him to do, and that was to seek some other outlet. Taking the torch from the niche, he set off down the corridor, sword in hand. He saw no sign of the serpent or its victim, only a great smear of blood on the stone floor. Darkness stalked on noiseless feet about him, scarcely driven back by his flickering torch. On either hand he saw dark openings, but he kept to the main corridor, watching the floor ahead of him carefully, lest he fall into some pit. And suddenly he heard the sound of a woman weeping piteously. Another of Sotha's victims, he thought, cursing the wizard anew, and turning aside, followed the sound down a smaller tunnel, dank and deep. The weeping grew nearer as he advanced, and lifting his torch, he made out a vague shape in the shadows. Stepping closer, he halted in sudden horror at the amorphic bulk which sprawled before him. Its unstable outlines somewhat suggested an octopus, but its malformed tentacles were too short for its size, and its substance was a quaking, jelly-like stuff which made him physically sick to look at. From among this loathsome, gelid mass reared up a frog-like head, and he was frozen with nauseated horror to realize that the sound of weeping was coming from those obscene, blubbery lips. The noise changed to an abominable, high-pitched tittering as the great, unstable eyes of the monstrosity rested on him, and it hitched its quaking bulk toward him. He backed away and fled up the tunnel, not trusting his sword. The creature might be composed of terrestrial matter, but it shook his very soul to look upon, and he doubted the power of man-made weapons to harm it. For a short distance he heard it flopping and floundering after him, screaming with horrible laughter. The unmistakably human note in its mirth almost staggered his reason. It was exactly such laughter as he had heard bubble obscenely from the fat lips of the salacious women of Shadizar, city of wickedness, when captive girls were stripped naked on the public auction block. by what hellish arts had Sotho brought this unnatural being into life? Conan felt vaguely that he had looked on blasphemy against the eternal laws of nature. He ran toward the main corridor, but before he reached it, he crossed a sort of small square chamber where two tunnels crossed. As he reached this chamber, he was flashingly aware of some small, squat bulk on the floor ahead of him. Then before he could check his flight or swerve aside, his foot struck something yielding that squalled shrilly, and he was precipitated headlong, the torch flying from his hand and being extinguished as it struck the stone floor. Half stunned by his fall, Conan rose and groped in the darkness. His sense of direction was confused, and he was unable to decide in which direction lay the main corridor. He did not look for the torch, as he had no means of rekindling it. His groping hands found the openings of the tunnels, and he chose one at random. How long he traversed it in utter darkness he never knew, but suddenly his barbarian's instinct of near peril halted him short. He had the same feeling he had had when standing on the brink of great precipices in the darkness. Dropping to all fours, he edged forward, and presently his outflung hand encountered the edge of a well, into which the tunnel floor dropped abruptly. As far down as he could reach, the sides fell away sheerly dank and slimy to his touch. He stretched out an arm in the darkness and could barely touch the opposite edge with the point of his sword. He could leap across it then, but there was no point in that. He had taken the wrong tunnel, and the main corridor lay somewhere behind him. Even as he thought this, he felt a faint movement of air. A shadowy wind rising from the well stirred his black mane. Conan's skin crawled. He tried to tell himself that this well connected somehow with the outer world, but his instincts told him it was a thing unnatural. He was not merely inside the hill, he was below it, far below the level of the city streets. How, then, could an outer wind find its way into the pits and blow up from below? A faint throbbing pulsed on that ghostly wind, like drums beating far, far below. A strong shudder shook the king of Aquilonia. He rose to his feet and backed away, and as he did, something floated up out of the well. What it was, Conan did not know. He could see nothing in the darkness, but he distinctly felt a presence, an invisible, intangible intelligence which hovered malignly near him. Turning, he fled the way he had come. Far ahead, he saw a tiny red spark. He headed for it, and long before he thought to have reached it, he caromed headlong into a solid wall and saw the spark at his feet. It was his torch, the flame extinguished, but the end a glowing coal. Carefully, he took it up and blew upon it, fanning it into flame again. He gave a sigh as the tiny blaze leaped up. He was back in the chamber where the tunnels crossed, and his sense of direction came back. He located the tunnel by which he had left the main corridor, and even as he started toward it, his torch flame flickered wildly as if blown upon by unseen lips. Again he felt a presence, and he lifted his torch, glaring about. He saw nothing, yet he sensed, somehow, an invisible, bodiless thing that hovered in the air, dripping slimily and mouthing obscenities that he could not hear, but was in some instinctive way aware of. He swung viciously with his sword, and it felt as if he were cleaving cobwebs. A cold horror shook him then, and he fled down the tunnel, feeling a foul, burning breath on his naked back as he ran. But when he came out into the broad corridor, he was no longer aware of any presence, visible or invisible. Down it he went, momentarily expecting fanged and taloned fiends to leap at him from the darkness. The tunnels were not silent. From the bowels of the earth in all directions came sounds that did not belong in a sane world. There were titterings, squeals of demoniac mirth, long shuddering howls, and once the unmistakable squalling laughter of a hyena ended awfully in human words of shrieking blasphemy. He heard the pad of stealthy feet, and in the mouths of the tunnels caught glimpses of shadowy forms, monstrous and abnormal in outline. It was as if he had wandered into hell, a hell of Sotho Lanti's making.
But the shadowy things did not come into the great corridor, though he distinctly heard the greedy sucking in of slavering lips and felt the burning glare of hungry eyes. And presently he knew why. A slithering sound behind him electrified him, and he leaped to the darkness of a nearby tunnel, shaking out his torch. Down the corridor he heard the great serpent crawling sluggishly from its recent grisly meal. From his very side, something whimpered in fear and slunk away in the darkness. Evidently the main corridor was the great snake's hunting ground, and the other monsters gave it room. To Conan, the serpent was the least horror of them, and he almost felt a kinship with it when he remembered the weeping, tittering obscenity and the dripping, mouthing thing that came out of the well. At least it was of earthly matter. It was a crawling death, but it threatened only physical extinction, whereas these other horrors menaced mind and soul as well. After it had passed on down the corridor, he followed at what he hoped was a safe distance, blowing his torch into flame again. He had not gone far when he heard a low moan that seemed to emanate from the black entrance of a tunnel nearby. Caution warned him on, but curiosity drove him to the tunnel, holding high the torch that was now little more than a stump. He was braced for the sight of anything, yet what he saw was what he had least expected. He was looking into a broad cell, and a space of this was caged off with closely set bars extending from floor to ceiling, set firmly in the stone. Within these bars lay a figure, which, as he approached, he saw was either a man or the exact likeness of a man, twined and bound about with the tendrils of a thick vine which seemed to grow through the solid stone of the floor. It was covered with strangely pointed leaves and crimson blossoms, not the satiny red of natural petals, but a livid, unnatural crimson, like a perversity of flower life. Its clinging, pliant branches wound about the man's naked body and limbs, seeming to caress his shrinking flesh with lustful, avid kisses. One great blossom hovered exactly over his mouth. A low, bestial moaning drooled from the loose lips. The head rolled as if in unbearable agony, and the eyes looked full at Conan. But there was no light of intelligence in them. They were blank, glassy, the eyes of an idiot. Now the great crimson blossom dipped and pressed its petals over the writhing lips. The limbs of the wretch twisted in anguish. The tendrils of the plant quivered, as if in ecstasy, vibrating their full snaky lengths. Waves of changing hues surged over them. Their color grew deeper, more venomous. Conan did not understand what he saw, but he knew that he looked on horror of some kind. Man or demon, the suffering of the captive touched Conan's wayward and impulsive heart. He sought for entrance, and found a grill-like door in the bars, fastened with a heavy lock, for which he found a key among the keys he carried, and entered. Instantly, the petals of the livid blossoms spread like the hood of a cobra, the tendrils reared menacingly, and the whole plant shook and swayed toward him. Here was no blind growth of natural vegetation. Conan sensed a malignant intelligence. The plant could see him, and he felt its hate emanate from it in almost tangible waves. Stepping warily nearer, he marked the root stem, a repulsively supple stalk thicker than his thigh, and even as the long tendrils arched toward him with a rattle of leaves and hiss, he swung his sword and cut through the stem with a single stroke. Instantly, the wretch in its clutches was thrown violently aside as the great vine lashed and knotted like a beheaded serpent, rolling into a huge irregular ball. The tendrils thrashed and writhed, the leaves shook and rattled like castanets, and the petals opened and closed convulsively. Then the whole length straightened out limply, and vivid colors paled and dimmed. A reeking white liquid oozed from the severed stump. Conan stared, spellbound. Then a sound brought him round, sword lifted. The freed man was on his feet, surveying him. Conan gaped in wonder. No longer were the eyes in the worn face expressionless. Dark and meditative, they were alive with intelligence, and the expression of imbecility had dropped from the face like a mask. The head was narrow and well-formed, with a high, splendid forehead. The whole build of the man was aristocratic, evident no less in his tall, slender frame than in his small, trim feet and hands. His first words were strange and startling. "What year is this?" he asked, speaking Kothic.
"Today
is the 10th day of the month Ulik, of the year of the gazelle," answered Conan.
"Yagulan Ishtar," murmured the stranger. 10 years.
He drew a hand across his brow, shaking his head as if to clear his brain of cobwebs.
"All is dim yet. After a 10-year emptiness, the mind cannot be expected to begin functioning clearly at once. Who are you?"
"Conan, once of Cimmeria, now king of Aquilonia." The other's eyes showed surprise.
"Indeed? And Nemedides?"
"I strangled him on his throne the night I took the royal city," answered Conan. A certain naivete in the king's reply twitched the stranger's lips.
"Pardon, your majesty. I should have thanked you for your service you have done me. I am like a man woken suddenly from a sleep deeper than death and shot with nightmares of agony more fierce than hell. But I understand that you have delivered me. Tell me, why did you cut the stem of the plant Yugotha instead of tearing it up by the roots?"
"Because I learned long ago to avoid touching with my flesh that which I do not understand," answered the Cimmerian.
"Well for you," said the stranger. "Had you been able to tear it up, you might have found things clinging to the roots against which not even your sword would prevail. Yogtha's roots are set in hell."
"But who are you?" demanded Conan.
"Men called me Peleus."
"What?" cried the king. "Peleus, the sorcerer? Sothalanthe's rival, who vanished from the earth 10 years ago?
"Not entirely from the earth,"
answered Peleus with a wry smile.
"Sotha preferred to keep me alive in shackles more grim than rusted iron. He pent me in here with this devil flower whose seeds drifted down through the black cosmos from Yag the Accursed, and found fertile field only in the maggot-writhing corruption that seethes on the floors of hell. I could not remember my sorcery and the words and symbols of my power with that cursed thing gripping me and drinking my soul with its loathsome caresses. It sucked the contents of my mind day and night, leaving my brain as empty as a broken wine jug. 10 years! Ishtar preserve us!"
Conan found no reply, but stood holding the stump of the torch and trailing his great sword. Surely the man was mad. Yet there was no madness in the dark eyes that rested so calmly on him.
"Tell me, is the black wizard in Khor Shemesh? But no, you need not reply. My powers begin to wake, and I sense in your mind a great battle and a king trapped by treachery, and I see Tsothalanthe riding hard for the Tibor with Strabonus and the king of Ophir. So much the better. My art is too frail from the long slumber to face Tsotha yet. I need time to regain my strength, to assemble my powers. Let us go forth from these pits."
Conan jangled his keys discouragedly.
"The grill to the outer door is made fast by a bolt which can only be worked from the outside. Is there no other exit from these tunnels?"
"No, only one, which neither of us would care to use, seeing that it goes down and not up,"
laughed Peleus.
"But no matter. Let us see to the grill."
He
He moved toward the corridor with uncertain steps, as of long unused limbs, which gradually became more sure. As he followed, Conan remarked uneasily, "There is a cursed big snake creeping about this tunnel. Let us be wary lest we step into his mouth."
"Huh, I remember him of old," Peleus answered grimly. "And more as I was forced to watch while 10 of my acolytes were fed to him. He is Satha, the old one, chiefest of Sotha's pets."
"Did Sotha dig these pits for no other reason than to house his cursed monstrosities?" asked Conan.
"He did not dig them. When the city was founded 3,000 years ago, there were ruins of an earlier city on and about this hill. King Kosas V, the founder, built his palace on the hill, and digging cellars beneath it, came upon a walled-up doorway, which he broke into and discovered the pits, which were about as we see them now. But his grand vizier came to such a grisly end in them that Kosas, in a fright, walled up the entrance again. He said the vizier fell into a well, but he had the cellars filled in and later abandoned the palace itself, then built himself another in the suburbs, from which he fled in a panic on discovering some black mould scattered on the marble floor of his palace one morning. He then departed with his whole court to the eastern corner of the kingdom and built a new city. The palace on the hill was not used and fell into ruins. When Akutho I revived the lost glories of Korshemish, he built a fortress there. It remained for Tsothalanti to rear the scarlet citadel and open the way to the pits again. Whatever fate overtook the Grand Vizier of Kosas, Tsotha avoided it. He fell into no well, though he did descend into a well he found and came out with a strange expression which has not since left his eyes. I have seen that well, but I do not care to seek in it for wisdom. I am a sorcerer and older than men reckon, but I am human. As for Tsotha, men say that a dancing girl of Shadizar slept too near the pre-human ruins on Dagoth Hill and woke in the grip of a black demon. From that unholy union was spawned an accursed hybrid men called Tsothalanti."
Conan cried out sharply and recoiled, thrusting his companion back. Before them rose the great, shimmering white form of Satha, an ageless hate in its eyes. Conan tensed himself for one mad berserker onslaught, to thrust the glowing faggot into that fiendish countenance and throw his life into the ripping sword strike. But the snake was not looking at him. It was glaring over his shoulder at the man called Peleus, who stood with his arms folded, smiling. And in the great cold yellow eyes, slowly, the hate died out in a glitter of pure fear, the only time Conan ever saw such an expression in a reptile's eyes. With a swirling rush, like the sweep of a strong wind, the great snake was gone.
"What did he see to frighten him?" asked Conan, eyeing his companion uneasily.
"The scaled people see what escapes the mortal eye," answered Peleus cryptically. "You see my fleshly guise. He saw my naked soul."
An icy trickle disturbed Conan's spine, and he wondered if, after all, Peleus were a man, or merely another demon of the pits in a mask of humanity.
All right there, folks. If you're still with me, you understand that the story is not done, but boy, is it long.
That's what she said.
I'm recording this bit almost a year after the first bit, and it's taken me a good long time to edit the story. It's just so long.
Mm-hmm.
It was about a 2.5 hour project, all recorded, and it looks like I'll get that down to about 1 hour 45 or so edited. Maybe a bit longer than that. But that is just too long. I've never done an episode that long as I am recording this. I just put out the my reading of Stephen King's Grandma. And that story itself was like 1 hour and 10 minutes long. And then, you know, I had an intro and then I had an outro. And I recorded a little extra bit for my Patreon supporters. And I even considered another recording session, just making it even longer because I liked that story so much. Wanted to talk about why it was so scary to me. But there has to be a point where you go, okay, enough is enough. This is too long. And on Scarlet Citadel, we have reached that point. So for the very first time ever, I'm going to split a podcast that dares not speak its name into 2 episodes. And maybe what I can do is I'm going on a trip at the end of October, beginning of November, and maybe I can have it drop around that time while I'm gone. I think that that's doable. And for a story this darn long, I would imagine that the listeners either hate the whole thing or they say, you know, I get why you'd split that into 2 parts. I'm with you, man. At least that's how I hope that it goes. So I don't really have much more to say about it in this episode. It's been long, right?
Come on.
But I appreciate you listening all the way through to the end, as usual. I hope that you enjoy these stories, these glimpses of stories that are now going on 100 years old. We'll probably talk a little bit more in the next episode about aspects of the story that become problematic in the 21st century, but maybe that's not necessary. You know what I'm talking about. I still find a lot of the world building, a lot of the story to be charming. I like the character of Conan, and I just like the sword and sandal, sword and sorcery, whatever you want to call this genre. It was very hard.
That's what she said.
For me to perform it. Hence, I'm still editing the sucker all these months later. But if you appreciated my work on it, then feel free to support me on Patreon. If you already support me on Patreon, feel free to give me a comment. Tell me what you think of these stories. There was somebody on the last Conan story that said that it was very hard for them to get through. And I understand that. It is a style of storytelling that is, I'm not going to say of its time, because I think it was really ahead of its time back in the 1930s, but it has fallen out of favor, let's say. And I wouldn't be surprised if that issue of Weird Tales that this appeared in proclaimed it to be, you know, a new novel by Robert E. Howard. I've seen that on pulp magazines and magazines in the 50s and stuff, where it's a long story and they proclaim it a novel. Let me know if hearing 2 of these in a year is too many, if you'd rather I just do 1 a year. I'm trying to keep Stephen King's stories to 1 a year, but I've got so many recorded that I am tempted sometimes to indulge. Anyhow, I hope that you enjoy these stories from yesteryear, these pulp adventure or horror stories. I really enjoy them, otherwise I wouldn't keep doing them. Patreon.com/Rish Outfield. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being a fan and a friend. And may all of your citadels be scarlet.
Whether by design
or dreadful mistake, you have been listening to the podcast that dares not speak its name, which was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 attribution, no derivatives license. By all means, listen, download, share the file with your bitterest friends and most beloved enemies, but the file shan't be sold, edited, or claimed as your own. The music provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com was also under a Creative Commons license. If, unlike me, you enjoy the show and would like to help it continue, please visit www.patreon.com/RishOutfield to donate $1 and up an episode and bring Rish Outfield back from the brink of despair. Though not of madness, that, my friends, has already claimed him.
You know which part of the road I'm at right here. There's only one part with the washboard rivets. Rivets? Divots.
Were I free, I'd give you a broken back. Did Shukelly send you here to mock me?
They even teased it before going to commercial. Mythical creature spotted amid Arizona wildfire? Mythical creature spotted amid Arizona wildfire? How did announcer man talk?
I'm announcer man. Mythical creature spotted amid Arizona wildfire.
One more time.
Mythical creature spotted amid Arizona wildfire. Coming up next.
The brass door let onto a narrow stair that seemed to wind down into the very bowels of the hill on which the citadel stood. Conan had a glimpse of his vulture-like figure through the thick-set bars. Figure through the thick-set bars as he slid home the grate.
One day, one of them will take his place. But not yet. Oh, not yet. Let's do that like Jeff Goldblum. But not yet. Oh, not yet. Maurice raises his hand and casts to the yellow-eyed glare at the tortoise shell that has just landed on the edge of the roof.